This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. It has been 25 years since the genocide in Rwanda, in which the ruling Hutu majority government slaughtered as many as 1 million Tutsi people. By most measures, life in Rwanda is vastly different today, as a full generation has been born since the end of the Civil War hostilities there.
But human rights observers say, despite the general changes for the better in Rwanda, there are reasons to be wary of the possibility of another genocide like the one from the 1990s. Karine Kaneza Nantulia is the Africa Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. She spoke at several events in Milwaukee recently and also stopped by the Lake Effect studio to chat with Bonnie North. Nantulia says part of the legacy of that time in Rwanda is linked to what's known as transitional justice.
Transitional justice is commonly referred as the body, a set of processes that a country, in collaboration with the international community, will set in motion in order to address a legacy of gross human rights violations. It's important because, and I'm saying this coming from a continent which has its own share of human rights abuses, it's important because people need to deal with what happened in their lives, whether it's about gruesome acts of violence, such as genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. So on one hand, you have the prosecution aspect of transitional justice, but at the same time, you also have to remember that victims, because we're talking about victims and perpetrators, need to have their suffering acknowledged. So you will have, for instance, an aspect of truth-telling to the transitional justice process. You will have an aspect of compensation, and some of it is symbolic, such as an acknowledgement of an apology by the state to its citizens. And at the same time, you also need to have, you might see aspects to the compensation that's material and financial as well. So it's a body of different processes, reparation, truth-telling, prosecution, where victims most of the time will be the center. Should be the center. It's not always the case, but victims should be the center of these processes.
What I like about the word transitional is the understanding that it doesn't end with a prosecution. It doesn't end with a verdict of guilty, that there is more to it.
There's rehabilitation. There's rehabilitation of the victim, but also of the perpetrators. Because when you think of gross human rights violations such as genocide, for instance, or crimes against humanity, these are most of the time crimes committed by people within their own countries, neighbors killing neighbors, parents killing children, children killing parents. So ultimately, when a community has been literally destroyed, its soul, its people, its institutions, the next phase is to acknowledge what has happened in terms of prosecuting the perpetrators. Yes, justice has to be rendered because that's what victims need. But at the same time, they also need to come to terms with the fact that these crimes were committed by people they knew. They were committed by people they might have loved, people they trusted. So how do you deal with that social and cultural aspect to the crime? And that's, unfortunately, when one reflects back, you would assume that some answers, clear answers, would have been found. Some have, but we're still grappling with that. We're still grappling with the fact that justice is not always rendered to its fullest. Victims up until now, when you think of countries like South Africa, for instance, with the end of apartheid and South Africa, which came up with a groundbreaking process called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you still, when you read the account of victims, you still see a level of insatisfaction, of frustration. Same thing in other countries. Sierra Leone is another example. In Uganda, in northern Uganda, with crimes committed by the Lord Resistance Army, how do you have a fulfilling process? I think that's what policymakers, transitional justice practitioners, lawyers, human rights advocates are still, I think, pursuing.
It's a work in progress.
It's a work in progress.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And now we're talking about genocide. We are at the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. Did we miss warning signs 25 years ago?
Genocide, and in the case of Rwanda, does not happen in a vacuum. Many people have said this before me. Many people will say this after me. It starts with an idea. It starts with what we call an ideology of genocide, which is rooted within how the country is governed. So it starts most of the time with the leaders. But it's also vehicled. It's actually driven at the smallest unit of a country, in families, inside families. Warning signs were there. They were there from the moment on an ID card you had the word Hutu and Tutsi. And that was during the colonial period. From the time you see a discrimination, a separation of identity, meaning of status, then you know that something is set in motion. So we saw the warning sign. The fact that a social, economic, cultural identity was transformed and moved from that to become an avenue for advantages, an avenue for discrimination, the warning sign was already alarming. And then you had separate treatment. You had institutional segregation of a minority, and in this case of Tutsis, for decades. And at the time when, and on the continent, especially in our region, every time there's going to be a talk of inclusion, a process that most of the time the international community is going to start by pushing for certain different governance dispensation, you will always have the radicals, you will always have those who want to retain power, who will then set in motion this terrible evil that was unleashed in Rwanda. So we saw the signs. Now the question we need to ask ourselves, if we were to see the same signs today, and we are, would we react earlier? Unfortunately, that answer has not been what we would expect. We look at countries like Burundi, a neighboring country. You look at countries like South Sudan. As we speak right now, there's a hybrid court that has been set up, a mixed court with participation of South Sudanese judges and AU. With the AU, it hasn't been set up yet. You still see hesitations. You still see a lack of political will. And yet we have 4 million people who have been displaced. We have women who have been raped. We have rape that has been deemed and legalized as a weapon, as a crime against humanity, still being used today, 25 years after the genocide in Rwanda, where actually rape was also used. So what do we do? What do we do with what we knew then? What we took as policy steps? We have the responsibility to protect that was adopted in 2005. Is it being used today? Do we see meaningful steps being taken to protect civilians, because that's why the responsibility to protect as a principle was adopted? We don't. I work for an organization that up until now, which documented, raised the alarm, and is still raising the alarm today, 25 years later. We need to take a step back, really looking at ourselves, looking at the international community, and really asking hard questions to policymakers, to leaders, and ask them, what have you learned? Because you've learned something. And why aren't you doing enough today?
And I sit here listening to you and think we don't seem to have learned anything. Or what we have learned, it's too difficult to put into place. It's too complicated, whatever the excuses are, to ignore the warning signs, the, you know, the failed attempts to make this. And so I have to ask you, do you ever lose hope that human beings will ever sit down and be able to look at themselves clearly enough and say, you know, we're doing it again. Here we are. We're doing it again. Hold up the mirror.
Here's what gives me hope. The youth on the continent. There is a wave of youth movements which has risen. The young people have risen in the last couple of years to actually own and push from the ground some dictatorships and some autocratic governments to actually do better by them. I'm always struck and I always admire youth movements. If you think of the Lucha movement in the DRC, you think of the protests that took place in Burundi in 2015, you think of Togo, you think of the youth movement in Nigeria, Ghana. You have all these different countries where young people are now more and more agents of change. And I think when we talk about the responsibility to protect as a principle, it is now being articulated to a certain extent by young people on the ground. It's unfortunate that at a higher policy level, it's still being used sometimes as a political tool as well, unfortunately. Have we not learned anything? Let me nuance that. After the genocide in Rwanda, some steps were taken. We have today the International Criminal Court that was established really as a response partly to what happened in Rwanda and, I must add, in former Yugoslavia. You have accountability, although misused and forgotten sometimes. Now, part and parcel, the discussion on governance and policies. You can't escape that. It's part of the discussions that policymakers have. They might not do something about it, but they're aware of it. You have criminal justice now being mainstreamed. It's been mainstreamed now in the discussion around governance, good governance, peace and security. It wasn't there before. So I like to keep hope while being realistic that few steps have been taken in terms of the consciousness. We are more aware. We are more conscious. It's very frustrating when you know that this rise in consciousness in the world has not been translated into something more tangible sometimes. We have, I'm just thinking aloud, but you have, for instance, the African Union recently has adopted a transitional justice policy. And this was in February 2019. And that was a process, that's a process that has taken 10 years, close to 10 years, to come to fruition. Basically to say, here we are, and we're going to adopt a transitional justice policy, looking at issues of justice, redress, compensation, reconciliation. It's a step forward. Now we do have a framework. When next time I'm talking to policymakers, when my colleagues are interacting with policymakers on the continent, we will be able to say, but you do have a framework.
It's here.
It's here.
Yeah.
So let's look at what are you doing in terms of the special court in Central African Republic? What are you doing with South Sudan? What are you doing with the prosecution of the perpetrators of the stadium massacre in 2009 in Guinea? So you have all these different issues we're working on, which will be able to be addressed within a certain framework adopted by member states themselves. So few inroads here and there. It's not perfect.
A few small victories.
They are small things one can push forward.
Do you think that what has been adopted, this transitional justice model that's been adopted by the African Union, are other countries, other regions looking at adopting similar things? Or is that more the purview of the UN for the Human Rights Commission at the UN?
No, it's going to be It was developed by the Human Rights and Transitional Justice Cluster within the Department of Political Affairs at the African Union. So it's going to be obviously addressed regionally, but with the intention of domesticating the regulations that will be that are within the policy at a national level. So one will be able to build obviously linkages. The AU, the UN, and the EU have obviously their own dialogue, and they have policy frameworks in which the three institutions meet and they interact, especially now currently on issues of migration, for instance. So there's room to basically try to have a discussion at an international level. But right now, when you think of Africa as a continent, this is a positive development. We'll be able to go to governments, national human rights commissions, and say, hey, this is what's happening. What are you doing? We'll be able to go to the, you know, hopefully in the near future, to the Africa Commission on Human and People's Rights and basically question some of the country's violations, if they are, on the basis of the policy.
So it does sound like between the youth movement and some of these small but very important policy steps that you are hopeful that not that we're going to necessarily change human nature, but that we're going to at least look at ourselves a little more closely and hold ourselves to account.
Definitely. The world is changing. The world is more interconnected. We have social media now. I was having a discussion with some of my colleagues and Nicole, and we were talking about how the phenomenon of the Me Too movement, you know, and the wave it has created inside the U.S. is something that could be looked at, you know, from other contexts. And this is just social media. This is just a campaign on social media. There are so many other campaigns. So we are all connected. We are more and more connected. And because of that, I think evil finds it difficult to hide, for instance. It's more and more difficult to commit gruesome acts of violence and gross human rights violations without being uncovered. It's more difficult today than it was in 1994. It's more difficult to basically indoctrinate citizens. In some countries, at least on the continent, there's an increased level of literacy 25 years down the line. So people are aware. Young people who actually were born after the genocide in Rwanda are more resilient. They are more bold. They've been emboldened enough to actually go on the streets and oust, sometimes push leaders to actually leave power. One wouldn't have thought of that 25 years ago. You look at processes on the continent where women have come forward. I'm thinking of women in Uganda during the LRA peace process, where victims would come forward and they would say, this is what happened to me. And those are some of the signs that societies have changed. Actually, we're talking about young people. They're way ahead of us. And hopefully these years are theirs, really.
And that we're not going to look back in another 25 years at another genocide that could have been prevented.
That is where I become sad. Because you do have, up until now, acts of violence that are still being investigated by commissions of inquiry, by the ICC. You have Burundi as a case where, when you read what has been written about Burundi, you might be able to actually come to the conclusion that genocide can happen, but it's not going to necessarily take the format and the magnitude in terms of the time it took, 100 years, to kill close to 1 million people. Now we have what has been coined in Kirundi, kamwe kamwe, one by one. So as much as we say that it's difficult to hide, perpetrators have also become cleverer as well and smarter. And that can be a whole discussion, how autocratic leaders have now become clever, understood. They have understood the expectations of the international community in such a way that they have a checklist. They will know that they need to hold seemingly democratic elections, even if they steal those elections, and these elections are not fair and not transparent. They know that they need to have a certain percentage of women, for instance, in parliament, and they will try to check all those boxes while at the same time maintaining and recruiting shadow militias. They will recruit young people and indoctrinate them. So you have these parallel systems where one is for the consumption of the international community and the other one is to really fulfill the thirst for power of some of these leaders. So that is what is, in my view, the most worrying trend, because the international community's attention is a very short one. You have competing interests. When you talk about Burundi, or you talk about Central African Republic, or you talk about Cameroon, at the same time, you have other interests. You will have a political crisis in the Middle East, for instance, or in Asia. And these countries, which, you know, have been coined in some of the writings that you see as forgotten crises, really, again, fall into oblivion, and policymakers will not be keeping a close eye on them. And that's how terrible things can happen again and are happening as we speak right now.
Which makes me both hopeful and very sad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But we must keep pushing. We must keep pushing, because I think evil can only take root when people are silent. Evil thrives when people are just standing by and not doing anything. Evil wins when we are not exposing it, when we are not documenting it. So that body of work must continue. And it's more and more, linking it to what I said before, more and more you will see that because criminal justice is so mainstreamed right now, leaders will actually be scared more with the threat of being indicted. It's a reality right now. You know, we have indictments. We have leaders who've been, not many, unfortunately, and who have been put on trial. Perpetrators who've been put on trial. Yeah, so those are some of the things that one has to keep remembering.
Well, Corinne Caneza Nantulya, it has been such an honor having you in this studio. Thank you very much for your good work.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And keep your good work. Keep spreading the word.
Corinne Caneza Nantulya is the Africa Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. She was in Milwaukee recently for events marking the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide and spoke with Bonnie North then.